Campus FM presents a talk organized by the Department of Youth and Community Studies entitled The European Youth Policy. This talk is delivered by Dr. Howard Williamson.
First of all, thank you for coming to this public lecture. I'd like to introduce Professor Howard Williamson. And some of you have already met him. For other people, this would be the first encounter. And I think Professor Williamson has a particularly an unusual perspective because he has participated in the three points of what we call the magic triangle. For those of you who are aware of this, it's the policy, practice, and research. I mean, Howard is a youth researcher, an academic, has published and done lots of research in the area of youth studies. He also chairs the Youth Experts Committee, correspondence of youth experts at the Council of Europe. He's also a practitioner. Till today, you're still an active youth worker. And he's been very much involved in policy development on a national level, on a local level in the UK, and also now on a European level. So he's able to give us a perspective that is not one-sided. Howard is also a commander of the Order of the British Empire. Am I correct? Yes, he's been appointed for the services towards young people. He was given this important position for his services to young people. So we're very, very happy to have him here today. And I'm going to leave it.
So no military talk back, okay? Major.
We are recording the session, so obviously Howard has been asked to use a mic.
Yeah, I hate them. Yeah. Horrible, aren't they? Okay.
Thanks, Alan.
All right, thank you. I've got to go up here, so I'll do that bit first because I've got to press the buttons on PowerPoint. You know how useless PowerPoint is. I've got an article I normally carry around with me called PowerPointless, and when used properly, and I'm not claiming I will use it properly, PowerPoint is okay. But most of the time, people use it terribly badly. They either read what's on the screen that you can read anyway, or the stuff they've got on the screen is nothing that they're talking about. You've all experienced those things. But about 2 or 3 years ago, my students were putting so much pressure on me to put everything on PowerPoint, put all my lectures on PowerPoint. Of course, like Dr. Azapardi, my friend Tony down here, you know, we're of the generation where we used to use sort of transparencies and felt pens, and we still like that feel. They're a bit more human, but technology takes us over. I've got a lot of slides, and some of them I'm not going to really elaborate on unless anyone here sticks their hand up and says, well, what on earth do you mean by that, in which case I'll try and elaborate them. What I want to do is a kind of two-circle kind of approach. One is the big picture, so that you have some brief idea of some of the key things that have taken place around thinking about young people and youth policy at a European level. And then I'm going to go into some detail around some of the things that I feel most comfortable with, that I've contributed most to, and that seems to be significant pieces in the jigsaw of something that we call youth policy. I would be a bit careful about calling it European youth policy. There is no such thing as European youth policy in any coherent sense. It's a bit like the term European citizenship. I do remind people that in 1996-97, you were not allowed in official circles to use the term European citizenship. You had to use the phrase citizenship with a European dimension. And we might translate that or transfer that to the in terms of youth policy to youth policy with a European dimension. but I do think that it is interesting how in the last 15 years both the European Commission and the Council of Europe have really accelerated debates about something called youth policy. If you actually track back to the early 1990s, there was very, very little discussion of this topic at all. Now, I haven't got time to do it here, but I sometimes, do a kind of quiz. You know, how big is the European Union? And normally people say, I don't know, 20, 25, 12. So sometimes you realize that you have to start at first principles. I say, how big is the Council of Europe? Most of my students don't know the difference. And then I say, well, it's bigger than the European Union. So they go, 30, 40. And the numbers up there just show the kind of dates and the size of the two institutions. The first one being the European Union, up to 27 now. And the second one being the Council of Europe, up to maybe 48 now. Serbia and Montenegro separated recently, so Montenegro is now a member of the Council of Europe. The Holy See, the Vatican, is sometimes included and sometimes not. Belarus, as a dictatorship, is sometimes included and sometimes not. So even people who work within the Council of Europe don't always agree on the numbers. But we know it's not 50 and we know it's not 45. Okay. The second thing I usually do to try and get some kind of dynamic going is to say, here are four dates. I'm going to tell you what they are, but you can just try and be ahead of me and think about it for yourselves. Here are four dates that have, in my view, been very significant in shaping the form of youth policy at a European level with a European dimension. 1968, Les Événements in Paris, the action by students and workers on the street, not just in France, but also in some other European countries, led politicians at a European level, at European community level, and Council of Europe level, to think we have to find better mechanisms for giving young people legitimate avenues to have their voices heard. Remember, this is long before the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child and Article 12 and that stuff. 1968. Because if we don't find better mechanisms for incorporating the perspectives of young people into our thinking, then we've got revolution on our hands. And the first European Youth Centre, the one in Strasbourg, was actually built and started operating in 1972. And it was built as a direct consequence of some of those concerns following Les Événements in 1968. The second key date, 1985, was International Youth Year. The United Nations, for the first time, established a year dedicated to young people with three core themes. Peace, obviously a major United Nations agenda. Participation, which was already the agenda of the Council of Europe. And development, and youth development. And we had a discussion on Tuesday, and we were talking about sort of youth work, youth issues, work with young people, and the African term for much of this is youth development. So, participation, peace, and development. And that year of youth, I don't know what happened in Malta, but certainly in the UK, it concentrated a lot of thinking about some broader idea of youth policy that was not just limited to youth work. It was around a wider range of issues. 4 years after International Youth Year, 1989, the Berlin Wall came down. Now, I sometimes say to Western European practitioners and young people that one cannot imagine the traumatic nature of the experiences, as well as the joy and elation about the collapse of communism. Many young people who are now very active players in the European stage, young adults, were 11, 12, 13 years old in 1989, and their whole world changed. Certainty was replaced with uncertainty. Comfortable living was replaced with precarious living. Fathers lost jobs, often had drink problems, often died young. Mothers who had state employment as teachers and engineers ended up as cleaners and washerwomen to keep the family going. And one of the challenges for institutions, particularly the two big European institutions, was how do we connect the experiences of teenagers and young adults from the former Eastern Bloc with the experiences of young adults from Western Europe. So the agenda didn't abandon participation, but it added intercultural tolerance and understanding, that sort of stuff. And of course, with all the conflicts, particularly in the former Yugoslavia, peace education has also become a significant kind of training issue in the wider Europe. So that was the kind of agenda, or one of the driving forces behind the youth agendas in the 1990s, and then there was 2001. Not in the Europe, in New York, but that whole issue about Islam, Christianity, Judaism, the clash of civilizations, as it was sometimes described, led trainers, youth work trainers, youth policy type of people in the big European institutions to think they needed to pay much more attention to the question of faith and interfaith and interreligious dialogue. So that's my sort of attempt to give you a big picture around those sorts of dates. Now, I'm not going to talk in detail about this, except to make one point. People still say, what on earth is youth policy? Your Minister of Education, who treated us to lunch today, we were talking about sort of education and a broad sense of education, and then even broader is this idea of youth policy. But some people say, well, where does youth policy reside? Who takes responsibility for it in a country, or indeed in Europe? And I once wrote in the 1980s, well, first of all, I wrote a hostile piece about youth policy. I actually said, if you have a youth policy, you need a middle-aged policy for people like me. And you need an old people's policy, and you need a children's policy. And you have to reconstruct your whole political and governmental agenda to deal with age groups rather than with issues. So there is a weakness about talking about the idea of youth policy. But let us assume abstractly that there is something called youth policy. Then it is a policy, as I wrote in, I don't know when, 1987, 88, something like that, by intent, default, or neglect. And that means that, as I said in the article I wrote, I can't even remember where I wrote it, but I said all kids grow up. Well, most kids do, a few die, but most of them grow up. And they grow up in societies. And societies either do intentional things to make their growing up a positive or a punitive experience, but some kind of experience which is actively thought about, or governments do nothing, neglect. But it's still a youth policy to do nothing. And you can have a default youth policy, which is you do minimal stuff. Or young people accidentally get affected by policy, but it's not been thought through. So one of the things at the European level was trying to produce some kind of purpose and intent in the youth policy thinking that they were doing. This is fairly obvious, but it's something that I tend to use for my students just to contextualize it. Does European youth policy matter? Probably not a great deal. Probably a bit more than UN youth policy matters, but rather less than local youth policy matters in terms of the real tangible experiences of young people. And the point about this diagram is that we have all these layers of youth policy. Sometimes the best advantage you have in understanding anything about European youth policy is the sentence in the funding application. This is consistent with the European White Paper on Youth Policy, which I'll talk about a bit later. So you don't actually have to know that much about European youth policy, but you impress the local funders, because it seems like you know a lot about what's going on in Europe. One of the difficulties is delivery in some countries. Spain can develop as many policies as it likes, building on the European and the global kind of youth agenda, but if Catalonia doesn't want to do it, it probably doesn't. And that applies in somewhere like Norway, with its hundreds and hundreds of tiny municipalities, which are almost completely autonomous. So there's always an issue about these big visions and how they convert into any kind of local reality. So what I'm going to do now is give you I mean, I don't know whether you've ever learned stuff about, you know, teaching and learning, but they always say people remember stuff in threes. So I've tried to organise this in a couple of sets of threes. There is one coming up that's got four in, which might be a bit tougher to kind of absorb, but do your best. I couldn't reduce it to three. But the next three slides are really going to tell you a little bit about what the European Union is doing. And some of you, I don't know whether there's anyone here from the Youth in Action programme, but if there is, then you will know this stuff pretty well. In 2001, the European Commission launched its white paper in Ghent in November 2001. The white paper is a somewhat pathetic document, really, given the fact it took 2 years to produce, but symbolically it is critical, because the European Union, European Commission, has only ever had about 20 white papers in its history. So to have one focused on young people is symbolically very important. The commissioner at the time, Viviane Redin, was so anxious that she would not secure a sufficient level of support for a white paper that even 2 months before, I think, no, 2 or 3 months before the launch of that white paper, she was mindful to reduce it to the level of a communication, as she put it. A communication being another kind of level of document coming out of the European Union. It took some rather concerted action by a number of people, including me, to persuade various politicians who were interested in youth issues to bend the ear of the president of the commission at the time, Neil Kinnock, Welsh MP, so I knew him pretty well, and Viviane Redin herself and other commissioners. The white paper started 2 years before, at the end of 1999, as a kind of blank sheet of paper. And very stupidly, Viviane Redin said to young people at various conferences, it's yours for the making. So they started to write things about, we want two young people as directors of every company that operates in the European Union. Ha ha ha, that's never going to happen. And so slowly they had to do a damage limitation exercise, and they ended up with this relatively narrow frame of reference that didn't touch on the other competencies of the Commission and touch on the things that the Commission was not supposed to touch at all. I don't know how much you know about the white paper, but it has four strands: participation, information, voluntary activities, and a better, greater knowledge of youth. Those are the four themes. It also talks about the need to promote the autonomy of young people, which is an issue I take issue with, although in the first ministerial conference after the white paper, I went to Murcia in Spain in 2002 to try to work out what they actually meant by this cry for autonomy, because I think we have to also look at support mechanisms. I don't know whether the concept will ring any bells with you, but in some academic literature, there's this discussion of the attempt in the modern world by government to promote the entrepreneurial self. In other words, leave it to individual young people to sort their lives out. And I don't think we should be doing that, but that's another story. So, that's the white paper. Second big EU development was that in 2005, the European Youth Pact, again, I don't know how many of you know about this, but this is much more strongly connected to the wider, the bigger European policy framework of the Lisbon Strategy, the strategy to make the European Union the most advanced knowledge-based economy in the world. And a 10-year strategy signed in Portugal under the presidency there in the year 2000 to be judged in year 2010, which is only next year. Okay, so we're probably not going to get there. But nevertheless, around 2004-05, there was a feeling within the EU that the youth agenda was too peripheral to the education and employment agenda of the Lisbon Strategy. So they established the Youth Pact, which had these three themes: education, employment, and quality of life, family, work-life balance, that sort of stuff. And countries within the European Union are required to report on an annual basis to the European Union about what they're doing on these kinds of key issues. And I rather like the remark made by, I think, by some senior official within the European Union at the bottom of this slide, which is, this is the first time that youth policy has featured so visibly at European Union level. It sounds to me that that civil servant had just joined the youth department within the Commission in Brussels, because there'd been plenty going on for at least 15 years around youth policy that he obviously knew nothing about. And then the third thing is the Youth in Action Programme. There was always this joke, and I know I've just realised I'm being tape recorded for this, so I'll probably be subjected to legal action from the Commission, but there, or maybe from the Council of Europe. But there was always this joke that the European Commission had the money and the Council of Europe had the brains, and you had to try to connect the two. There was another kind of, not so much a joke, but a similar contrast, that the EU only had programmes, whereas the Council of Europe had policies. And the EU had been very active from the late 80s, early 90s, with a range of programmes, the Youth for Europe programme, number one and number two, then the Youth programme, capital letters, and now 2007 to 2013, the Youth in Action programme. English speakers recognise that the word inaction, when joined together, means doing nothing. And I did point this out to people in Brussels, that it was not a very good term to you to describe the new programme, but they were thinking in French at the time, so it didn't sort of didn't connect. So we have to say Youth in Action, okay? this has all those things that some of you will know about youth exchanges, the European Voluntary Service Programme, expert exchanges between practitioners, and so on, around the usual themes of citizenship and intercultural understanding. And it's good stuff. It's got big budgets, and, you know, I don't know how Malta benefits from this programme, but I know in my country, in Wales, we don't punch our weight in terms of securing the resources that we ought to be securing to take our young people to new experiences in other parts of Europe. So those are the three big things in EU terms. I'll bring these together a bit later, but in terms of Council of Europe, I'm not going to bore you with this, but every so often, youth ministers meet. The first time they met was in Strasbourg, I think, in 1986. I could be wrong about that date. And the last time they met was in Kiev last October. And they always come up with some kind of pronouncements. And they're the usual bland pronouncements. We want to promote more participation. We want to promote active citizenship. We want to deal with youth unemployment. We want to achieve greater gender equality. We want to include ethnic minorities. There's a list there, if you can see it just about. In a sense, it is very vacuous rhetoric. In another sense, it is at least a statement by relatively senior politicians that these are important agendas at a European level. So it's worth kind of checking up on these from time to time and seeing how they connect with local and national agendas for young people, enterprise development, youth at risk, those sorts of things. The second thing, which I'll probably refer to a bit later, I'm not going to dwell on it, but in 1996, Finland, as a bit of a cunning plan to get a Finn appointed as the director of the Youth Directorate in Strasbourg, suggested that the Council of Europe should start doing international reviews of national youth policies. And nobody knew what they were talking about, so they said, well, we'll volunteer to do Finland first. And I was the rapporteur for the first review in Finland. Tony's done Slovakia and been involved in others, and of course been the host to a review of Malta in 2002. But the idea, and in 1997 nobody knew what the idea was, but so the idea has kind of evolved. There wasn't a set of terms of reference, but the idea, as far as I can see, is that it was an attempt to help a country think through what it was doing for its young people. It was an attempt to discover ideas in those countries that they could take back to the 48 countries of the Council of Europe. Cyprus have some great youth information shops. Finland's got a great system of youth participation, virtual youth participation, or whatever it may be. And thirdly, to start to shape a set of standards and ideas about youth policy at a European level. That was the kind of framework that I started to suggest might be the rationale for these reviews. Now, there'd be loads of these reviews. Finland, 1997, and then they rolled on through the Netherlands and Spain and Sweden and Romania and Estonia and Luxembourg. That was the first seven. And then I wrote a book based on a kind of summary of the messages that come out of those seven first reviews. Grounded, everything I wrote in that book comes straight out of the seven international and seven national reports that, if you like, paired up, reflected those seven reviews. And then we did seven more reviews, Lithuania, Malta, I'm trying to think, Norway, Slovakia, Cyprus, Armenia. And in the last couple of years, we've done Latvia and Hungary. Moldova is being finished at the moment, and Albania is just starting. And in 2011, Belgium, all three communities of Belgium, will be subject to one of these reviews. And you may want to ask about that a bit later. Those are the countries. After the second seven, I wrote another book because lots of new issues had arisen. And again, without going into detail, but you might want to talk about them. In 1997, the new Europe was seen as a fantastic place for the mobility of young people. Finland, the national report from Finland said one in three young Finns interrails around Europe every year. What a great opportunity for studying, traveling, meeting new people. No thought at that time had been given to questions of the trafficking in women. The negative mobility of young people who were moving from poorer parts of Europe to richer parts of Europe. So nobody had given much thought to radical Islam. And certainly nobody had given any thought to reactionary fascist and communist tendencies amongst young people in Eastern Europe who don't want to be in the EU anymore. They'd rather, because it hasn't given them anything, they'd rather be back under the Soviet system. And just this is just a point of information for you, really, because there are also things called advisory missions. Tony's been part of some, I think. Which one? Croatia, yeah. I've been part of a few. And these are a bit like mini reviews. They're confidential. The reviews are public. These advisory missions are private. And they are a private agreement between governments and a small team, usually four people, who go along and help thinking through certain kinds of issues, whether that's to do with youth worker training, or maybe one I did in Slovenia, which was about a kind of youth policy, a national youth policy, writing some kind of framework ideas. So different kinds of things, but a body of knowledge has accrued from these advisory missions, although it's rather sensitive about what we do with them. And the fourth thing here with the Council of Europe is to do with measuring youth policy. How do we go about judging whether the policies have worked? And a dear friend of Tony's and mine, and Marilyn's, Miriam's, Peter Lauritsen, who died a couple of years ago, but Peter was the first educational tutor in 1972 in Strasbourg, a great political scientist, a deep thinker about youth policy, and in 2003 he chaired a small group of people, I was a member of it, on the subject of youth policy indicators. What are the kind of key planks of youth policy development that you need to see in European countries if youth policy is going to start to develop effectively. And these were the kinds of things that he came up with: legislation, budgets, structures, interventions, and various positive indicators, decline in crime, and positive indicators such as increase in school attendance. And I'll come back to indicators, because we still haven't really got our act together in terms of youth policy in Europe around what kinds of indicators, benchmarks should we be looking at. So we're nowhere near the kind of PISA study models, the OECD models that apply to formal education. And here, this is, I suppose, at the heart of what I wanted to talk about today, because over those 16 or 17 international policy reviews, through my personal participation in loads and loads of different kind of working parties and working groups, I have slowly composed seven areas which might be viewed by some people, are viewed by some people, as a framework for thinking about youth policy in Europe. Because all countries do it slightly differently, but the framework seems to be helpful and valuable to those countries. I was in Sweden at the end of November, and you know, I arrive in Stockholm and find myself as the fifth member of the Swedish delegation of the visiting South Africans. What am I doing this? I'm an honorary Swede for the following morning. And I'm sitting there talking to the South African Minister for Development, for Youth Development, former ANC guy, you know, sort of radical. And the Swedes tried to sell them the Swedish model. And you could feel the South Africans didn't want to know. You know, we're not Sweden. We're a rather different country in terms of resources and capacity and challenges. So when it came to me, I tried to sell them this framework. I said, here's a framework for you to think about your country. And I don't know whether it's true, but from the body language of the Minister for Youth Development, he looked like he was kind of thought, this is quite helpful. And what I said to him, and what I say to lots of other people, is the first thing is, what are the concepts that you're grappling with? Who are young people in your country? Here, 12 to 30. Well, I suspect that you will have to narrow that down to something like 11 to 19 or 11 to 25. You may not. Some countries, it's 0 to 30. I keep praying it'll be 30 to 60 soon, but, you know. The old communist countries still use the old Komsomol model, 16 to 30. In England, it's 13 to 19. In Wales, it's 11 to 25. So, but it doesn't just have to be on age, because you can argue that some young people remain young for longer, for various reasons. You know, maybe because of vulnerability, disability, who knows? They may or may not. But you've got to have some notion of who the audience is for this policy that you may be thinking of developing. And the second thing is, you've got to have some notion of what the policy contains. How broad is it? How deep is it? In the early days in the Council of Europe, you talked about youth policy, and they thought youth policy was non-formal education. Then you started to talk to them about youth policy, and they saw it in terms of all sorts of positive developmental things. And then Awkward Squad Me came in and said, but hang on a minute, you know, youth justice is part of youth policy. And they didn't like that, because that was kind of social control rather than social empowerment. But it's still part of youth policy, in my view. And one of the advantages of doing those two books, and you know, at first we, and of course this will not be surprising to any of you from this country, but we never took into account the role of the church in youth policy in some of the early reviews. It didn't seem to matter, it didn't seem to count. But when you've done policy reviews of Cyprus and Armenia and Malta and Moldova, different churches, different faiths have a huge influence on youth policy, both for good and for bad, in terms of actually serving the youth policy agenda and obstructing it. So we have to think about, what do we mean by youth policy? So that's the first bit of territory. Have a proper discussion, otherwise down the track you'll be completely confused. Secondly, what's the kind of governing infrastructure for your youth policy? legislation, budgets. And it's not about saying precisely how many Maltese pounds or euros or whatever it may be are in the kitty, but it's actually saying, is there a provision in the financial processes of the government to actually allocate certain funds to a youth policy agenda? Because if there's not, very little will happen. In some countries of Europe, if you do not have a law, nothing happens. In other countries of Europe, you don't have to have a law for things to happen. So legislation is sometimes important and sometimes unimportant, but you have to work out what's the kind of infrastructure that might make things happen. That's the second thing. The third thing is, what structures for delivery do you have? You can write youth policies till the cows come home. If you haven't got regional and local delivery mechanisms, then it gets stuck at the central level. And I won't name and shame them here, but I could name you countries that have the most marvellous youth policies in their capital cities. And I can guarantee absolutely nothing ever reaches young people. So you've got to think about how do you have those, and that may be through the state, it may be through local authorities, regional councils and then municipalities, it may be through voluntary sector, NGOs, it may be through other agencies. And quite honestly, I don't care how things reach young people, but the critical thing is that they need to, you have to have mechanisms for young people to be reached, and the right young people as well. So that's the third thing. That's all kind of preparatory stuff. Then you have the kind of youth policy territory, and here I'm going to steal those words that we talked about yesterday, all right? We've got youth policy themes, as your draft youth policy document is talking about, fairly predictable to start with, at least education, employment, vocational training, health, housing, volunteering, and then you get into things like environment, perhaps. I mean, Serbia's got 8 themes and one of them is environment. So everyone has slightly different themes, but they have a set of issues that they believe youth policy should be addressing. And of course the critical thing there is that they're all working in the same direction. They're not sort of, one bit of that policy is not working in opposition to another bit of that policy. But that's another debate. And then, so that's the fourth thing. The fifth thing, here we go, ready? Youth policy threads. This is we were sitting yesterday in Gozo and we were talking about a kind of tapestry. That you've got the youth policy themes going that way, but this way you've got some threads that need to be considered across those policy domains, as I call them, your youth policy themes. Youth information, whether that's about schooling or health or housing. Social inclusion, where you bring in gender equality, issues about disability, ethnic minorities. Social inclusion as one of those threads that runs through all the youth policy themes. And different countries will have different priorities, because they're at different stages of youth policy development. You don't need it probably in Malta, but some of those countries, Croatia, Bosnia and Herzegovina, Kosovo, when that becomes fully independent and a member of the Council of Europe, those are countries where nation building is at the very heart of their youth policy aspirations. So they will have a slightly different set of threads from those that might prevail in my country. So that's 5. Number 6 are themes to do with enabling youth policy to be effective. And I reckon that there's 3, there's probably more things, but the first thing is youth research. Now this is not a bid for more research to Marilyn and the youth studies people and so on, but it is saying that, on what basis is youth policy constructed? Where do the ideas come from? Do they come from some bright idea of some politician? Which usually they do, to an extent, or some stupid idea of some politician. That's also quite common. Are they tested against certain kinds of empirical evidence? Are they tested against young people's experiences? So what's the kind of research knowledge base for youth policy development. That's the first one of that sub-point. The second one is dissemination of good practice. What kinds of platforms do you have? Journals, internet, conferences. What kinds of spaces and places do you have to share your practical experience of working with young people? What seems to have worked in one place? And it's not just, you don't have to wait for 3 years for research to happen. It's good to have dialogue and listen to other people. Some countries, I mean Cyprus, you might, some of you will probably know, Cyprus has two ZEP schools, Zones of Educational Priority, one in Limassol and one in Nicosia. Great schools. They have Turkish Cypriots attending those schools. They're not governed by the Greek educational curriculum. And they're kind of tolerated. They are exemplary schools, but they are kind of tolerated. But they're not really allowed to share their good practice in case some other schools get the idea that they might want to copy them. Okay? So don't grasp me up to the Republic of Cyprus government, please. And the third thing is the training of professionals. Now, this is a hard thing for me to say in the context of Malta, because you are alone in the world, for, as I said the other day, for having professional training and no jobs. So you are probably the most skilled and knowledgeable and expert volunteers in the world. Okay? But other countries in Europe, you go to Latvia or Lithuania, and you could have armies of volunteers to work with young people, but they have no training and no expertise in a formal sense. I always have to be very careful, because I am not having a go at volunteers. We need volunteers to be working with young people. But we don't want volunteers who feel out of their depth in the challenges they face in the work they're doing. And so we do need to have a framework of professional training. Who is going to be doing this work on health education? Who is going to be doing this work on youth justice? And, of course, many countries have very, very low levels or non-existent levels of training provision for the people who are going to be expected to do this work. And particularly when you get into the arena of the really tough kids, you need some pretty sophisticated skills to be able to work effectively with them. So that's the kind, and finally, you've got the monitoring evaluation questions. And that takes me back to the indicators point. What are your benchmarks? I remember when we were in Armenia, and I said, well, you know, if we kind of use Western European notions of social exclusion and inclusion as one of our kind of benchmarks, the whole of Armenia is excluded, is it not? So do we test it against some kind of World Health Organization benchmark? You can pick different benchmarks. I was saying to the Albanian and the Moldovan governments earlier this year, since Christmas, that when it comes to benchmarks, I don't want to hand you one. Here's one from Strasbourg. Take it. Use it. I want you to think about what is a meaningful benchmark for you in terms of making progress. Because I don't really know, in the necessary detail, where you've come from and where you want to get to. But somehow judging those stepping stones. Now, I'm just going to throw these things at you, otherwise I'll be here all night and you'll be completely fed up. This is called the five C's, the components of youth policy. It actually comes from sitting in a State Council for Youth Affairs in Lithuania in 2002, and they got something called the Youth Policy Concept, not a law, but something called the Youth Policy Concept from 1996. And I was doodling concept, and drawing this C on a bit of paper. And suddenly I started to kind of get on a roll. And I came up with these five C's. And I wrote about them. And then they seem to have stuck. Coverage has three elements: geography, social groups, and social issues. In other words, when youth policy is being thought of, who are you aiming it at? It might work brilliantly in the capital city of a country. Is it going to work in the countryside? Does it work in the countryside? And it might be aimed at young people generally, but is it really reaching the most excluded groups? So that's about coverage. Then there's capacity, which is the training question. It's about the infrastructure question. It's all very well having lots of bright ideas. Is there any money? Is there any legislation? Is there any human resource at a kind of governmental delivery level to make it happen? The third is what I've just talked about, professionalism. Do you actually have the competence to deliver? I mean, we were talking again earlier this week about youth-friendly clinics, which are the flavour of the month, even in the draft document you've got. I don't think you should have it, but that's my view. But I went to one Eastern European country that the minister is absolutely obsessive about youth-friendly clinics. So I went and visited one, and there's a photo of the minister opening it, and they'd not even thought about confidentiality principles. You know, because I said, you know, what's your procedure on confidentiality? Huh? What do you mean? So, again, I don't want to criticise the person who was running that particular youth-friendly clinic, but it seemed to me that she was leaving herself wide open to a whole host of difficulties through not having the professional competence to think through that stuff. Then there's coordination. It's the usual thing in all countries. Who's talking to who? Do your ministries talk to each other? At a more local level, do people talk? I know you'd probably say yes, they do, because everybody knows each other in Malta. Yeah, I mean, they talk to each other too much, maybe. In most countries, there isn't a dialogue at horizontal levels across government, across regional authorities, across local authorities, and there's not an opportunity for sufficient dialogue between the ground and the decision makers. So, a kind of vertical dialogue. And the final thing is the very predictable thing about what are the resources needed, financial and human. Easy to write documents, easy to put paper together, but you do need real resources. I like following the alphabet, so I came up with some D's after the C's. And a couple of years later, reading all these international reviews of European youth policy at national level, I came up with four D's, and then somehow they became eight D's. I'm not even going to talk about them particularly, but it's a cycle. And what I think is useful about it is that people often say, we've got to wait for the minister to make a decision. Utter rubbish. Youth policy, I've known in other parts of the world and in some parts of Europe, have developed because of exemplary projects, practice on the ground. So I started to put these D's together, because usually at the heart of policy development is political championship. If you can't persuade your minister that X or Y needs doing, it's likely to float around forever. But ministers have to have a strategy for decentralizing their ideas so that you get real delivery. But real delivery always throws up things that nobody had ever thought of. I lived in a country for 15 years under Margaret Thatcher and John Major where they decided on something and you had to deliver it, and although everybody knew all the problems, they said that's how you got to do it. And actually you just spent loads of public money ineffectually with mainly young people who are unemployed. You've got to have a mechanism for revealing a confidence to reveal the difficulties and have a discussion, a debate about these things. Because only with a debate do you start to think about how you resolve the problems, the difficulties you're encountering. But when you have a debate, and this is probably the problem with Malta, small country, one group of people are having a debate, they've decided on something, another group disagree completely about the direction of travel that needs to be taken now. That's the dissent. Have the debate. Youth workers, get round the table, get in a room, thrash out the argument. But don't start debating your differences in public. Sooner or later, you've got to come to some agreement. This is the direction we want to go. It may not be perfect, but it's the best way we think will work. Then you produce development and direction, and you sell it to the politicians. No politician wants to listen to a bunch of people bickering amongst themselves. Politicians want a clear line of argument. And if they feel they've got a clear line of argument from a defined constituency of people, politicians will run with your agenda and offer you the political championship, the political drive that you need to take things forward. And the point about that cycle of development is that it can start or stop at any place at any time. And again, I kind of put this model together some time ago, and everybody thought it was quite interesting. Right, I know I've been talking a long time, and just very quickly, because this is the important thing about the 2000s, that until the end of the 1990s, the European Commission was doing its bit, and the Council of Europe was doing its bit, and very rarely did they talk to each other. They still don't sometimes. But they do a lot more than they used to on youth policy questions. And one of the reasons is that although they still have two separate entities around youth policy, they also have partnership arrangements. These partnerships started in 1999 with something called the Quality and Curriculum Development Group. So it was around training of European level youth. Is there anyone in this room who's part of the trainers pool, just out of curiosity, before I put my foot completely in it? That's all right, I'd say it anyway, but there is a trainers pool, and these people who do all this intercultural learning, you know, sort of bring young people from different countries together, they are sort of within this pool. So we developed a set of quality standards, really, about admission to the pool and allowing people to stay in the pool. So that was the first kind of partnership. Then the second partnership was around youth research. I'm not going to dwell on this, but it has culminated in something called AKEEP, the European Knowledge Centre on Youth Policy, which was launched under the Luxembourg EU presidency a few years ago, 2005, and is a website where you can access quite a lot of knowledge and understanding of the different constituent countries of the European Union and beyond. It's compulsory for people in the EU to deliver the relevant information. It's optional for a wider group. And Miriam is your person who services that knowledge centre as best she can on behalf of Malta. We have an MA in European Youth Studies that I'm closely involved in. It's still being developed. I was just talking to Tony about this, as Tony was one of the early architects of this thinking. And it's still rolling on. How many years later, Tony? 3 years later, yeah. And again, Miriam's involved in something, as I am, in a new initiative under this research partnership around the history of youth work in Europe. Look out for the book coming out. Miriam's got a chapter in it. Okay. And then, since May 2005, training, research, and European Mediterranean cooperation, which I have very little to do with but is very relevant to you, are three strands that have been brought together under a united partnership between the European Union and the Council of Europe. I was supposed to be going to Sharm el Sheikh a couple of weeks ago to speak to the League of Arab States about youth policy, but didn't make it. But the Euro-Mediterranean stuff, every time the European Union enlarges, it has a neighbourhood policy. And then, of course, these days, the neighbours are our African neighbours and our Middle Eastern neighbours. So there's a lot of youth development work being done around those places. And, of course, the three key challenges all the time are labour market issues around, from youth unemployment to labour market insertion, civil society issues about youth participation and citizenship, and social inclusion challenges, social integration challenges. I'm not going to bother with that. Oh, sorry about that one. Just for information, you might know about the All Different, All Equal campaign. I don't know how much you did in Malta, but you probably got a T-shirt if you did something in Malta. I will put my slide up because I like this. This is in the Commonwealth of Independent States, you know, where Putin speaks all the time in St. Petersburg. I'd been in this lecturing place in 1992 when it was mothballed, nicotine-stained, and unused. And I went to see the kind of chief executive of St. Petersburg in 1992. And then in 2006, I wandered into this wonderful lecture theatre with all these flags and thought, I've been here before. Completely different. So, and there's a guitar over there which I carried up with me, but that's a different story. anyway, that's the picture on the advertising poster. And we had an All Different, All Equal campaign 10 years ago, in 1995, in the Council of Europe. The whole question of the alliance of civilizations, the human rights issues, and the questions of diversity and participation are massive in the modern Europe. Nearly at the end, last October in Kiev, European youth ministers signed the new direction of the Council of Europe's youth policy, Agenda 2020 as it's called. It has three key components: human rights and democracy, the social inclusion of young people, and living together in diverse societies. Now, just to show you that not everything is wonderfully coherent and that people speak to each other, while that document was being produced for the ministers, the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe, which is the members of Parliament, had asked me to write a vision for the future, refreshing the youth agenda in the Council of Europe. And I came up with mobility, faith and generation. So you've got mobility, faith and generation in one bit of the Council of Europe, and you've got these three things in another bit of the Council of Europe. Now, if you're smart politically, you can see that they can feed into each other. And the person who launched Agenda 2020 in Kiev, Gavin Titley from the National University of Ireland, we were in the pub the night before, and Gav said to me, I told him all about this Parliamentary Assembly stuff, and Gav, very cleverly, in his 20-minute speech, he managed to pull my stuff into his stuff and fitted it neatly together. Very finally, these are just things that are currently on the bubbling under. Last October the 17th in Brussels, the European Commission had its first meeting, one of many, to try to think about where does the EU want to be going on the youth policy agenda? Does it want to continue with the four strands of the white paper, which are rather tired now, they're 8 years old? Or are there new kinds of issues that need to be considered? There is debate about issues such as youth violence, something that was not really a debating point in youth policy 10 years ago. Issues to do with trafficking and negative mobility, and other things. You can see migration and so on. The Council of Europe is particularly interested in anchoring itself in some kind of historical understanding about where its current work has come from. If you think about youth work in Malta, and then you compare that to youth work in Germany, where 1945, the Hitler Youth and all that Nazi stuff was just stopped, and a whole new way of doing youth work emerged. So huge fractures in the trajectories of youth policy and youth work in some countries, and significant continuities in other countries. So the Council of Europe is has already held this one event on the history, and is, when is it, in May, in Blankenberge in Belgium, is holding another event to get information from more of the European countries. And right now, I haven't started writing it, but right now I'm discussing with the parliamentarians who are linked to something called the Congress of Local and Regional Authorities in Europe, which is the local authority level, but it's part of the Council of Europe. Their big agenda at the moment is the social integration of young people from disadvantaged areas. And I'm currently writing 15 pages to kind of inform them of, give them a platform for some dialogue in the Parliamentary Assembly. So that's where we are now. One of the things for me that is quite difficult, talking to you and talking to anybody really, is that I have been submerged and immersed in this stuff since 1985. And increasingly I've become quite a particularly since Tony retired, I've become probably in pole position to lead on quite a lot of these agendas. I coordinate the international reviews for the Council of Europe at the moment, and have done since Peter died. I won't do it forever, but I will have done it for 4 years. So it gives me a very privileged insight into both the significant progress that has been made around youth policy in Europe and many of the hiccups and difficulties and sticking points. For you, you probably feel completely bombarded with lots and lots of stuff that you've never heard of, or completely fed up because you knew it all anyway. But I doubt the latter. And in a sense, the important thing in terms of understanding the European scene is to work out how it fits for you in terms of your national youth policy development, and make sure that whenever possible you have a good enough understanding of the youth policy framework in Europe to make reference to it and use it as part of your ammunition when you're actually trying to have your dialogue and your sort of politicking with your key decision makers in this country. So that's it. Thank you very much. Right, nasty questions, please.
We practice non-formal education, but nobody knows what is non-formal education. And I don't know whether you recall this remark as well, on a lighter note as well, what is youth policy? And this minister replied by saying, youth policy is the amount of money I have in my budget.
Yeah, yeah. In fact, Slovakia, in the report that Tony authored, but of course it's a collective venture, so it's the team who produced the report, and we rapporteurs are the people who really reflect those ideas. There's a line in Tony's report which says, it's a quotation from a respondent, that they don't know what non-formal education is in Slovakia. And when that report was published, no, just before it was going to be published, the new government representative for Slovakia came to a governmental meeting in Budapest. And she said to me, can you take out this sentence from the report, because it's embarrassing to our government? And I said, but the team are not saying that they don't know what non-formal education is in Slovakia. The team are reflecting a remark that was made by a relatively senior official about non-formal education. And it's a trick, and it's a challenge, and it's very difficult to try to communicate a constructive criticism to some of these countries, because any criticism is taken very, very deeply. And Tony and I and others, as, if you like, independent academic rapporteurs, have had to accept, and Peter, the guy who died, who's a friend of ours, was this in this role that I'm about to describe. We wrote what we believed needed to be written, and then Peter would counsel us privately, before it went anywhere else, that certain things were diplomatically very sensitive, and could we consider an alternative way of presenting it? Because there is absolutely no point in consuming significant international resources of the Council of Europe, and in the process significant national resources of poor countries, because ministers like to take us out for a nice meal and show us the sights. There's no point in ending up having produced such a report in such a way that there's a barrier to any acceptance of it. That's very difficult, because sometimes people feel that we have compromised too much. We've lacked courage to speak powerfully enough about issues, particularly about minority rights in some countries, certainly about lesbian, gay, and bisexual and transgender issues in some of those countries, where you know that if you have, and even in this country, as you might know from the international report, the international team did not meet, you have a gay rights sort of youth organization, and wasn't allowed or didn't meet that group, but they did actually contribute an appendix to the international report, just a page, about their concerns. So ideally we try to maintain a positive relationship with the relevant ministry, and work through them But ultimately, we are independent and we take our knowledge from as many sources as we can. And if necessary, we ask other people to come in a different way with their information. Turkish Cypriot youth organisations, for example, when we reviewed Cyprus, it was pretty difficult to allow them to channel their ideas through the Republic, through the Cyprus Youth Board. But I just gave my email to any of the Turkish Cypriot youth organisations from the north of Cyprus and said, if you've got anything to say, send me an email and I'll weigh it up along with everything else. But again, you don't want to write stuff that provokes the legitimate government of the country, otherwise it's a counterproductive process.
You have just listened to a talk organized by the Department of Youth and Community Studies entitled European Youth Policy. This talk was delivered by Dr. Howard Williamson.